Thank you, Sharon. I'm not sure about you, but I found myself singing along in my head. And I have to, even a little bit of the motions. Because that's just how it goes. I'm guessing you may not remember every sermon all the way back to June or so. We hope that we make connections where we can, but I'm also fairly realistic in how long-lasting the particulars might be. But if you go back, you would find that, well, this was a text that started us in our sitting with the Sermon on the Mount and will now end us here. And we come back here both because it's the right place to end. It's literally the end of the sermon. But also because it brings us back to the foundational principles and sayings and reasons that make the sermon what it is and why it's important. So these are our foundational words. This is Matthew 7, verses 12 through 20, and then 24 through 29. In everything you do to others, in everything, do to others as you would have them do to you. For this is the law and the prophets. Enter through the narrow gate. For the gate is wide, and the road is easy that leads to destruction, and there are many who take it. For the gate is narrow and the road is hard, it leads to life, and there are few who find it. Beware of false prophets, who come to you in sheep's clothing, but inwardly are ravenous wolves. You will know them by their fruits. Are grapes gathered from thorns or figs from thistles? In the same way, every good tree bears good fruit, but the bad tree bears bad fruit. A good tree cannot bear bad fruit, nor the bad tree bear good fruit. Every tree that does not bear good fruit is cut down and thrown into the fire. You will know them by their fruits. Everyone who hears these words of mine and acts on them will be like a wise man who built his house on a rock. The rain fell, and the floods came, and the winds blew and beat on the house, but it did not fall, because it had been founded on rock. And everyone who hears these words of mine and does not act on them will be like a foolish man who built his house on sand. The rains fell, and the floods came, and the wind blew and beat against that house, and it fell, and great was its fall. Now, when Jesus had finished saying these things, the crowds were astounded at his teaching. For he taught them as one having authority, and not as the scribes. There are times where we know our words well, and the quotes even better. And there's lines that just stick with us, and that's what we have. It's a nugget of speech or time or whatever that elevates itself as among the most important in a given line. For whatever reason, even though it's well before my time, I'm drawn to one of John Kennedy's famous lines of "I it ein Berliner," and speaking in front of the Berlin Wall, expressing solidarity with the people of Berlin. Thank you. It was falling off there. The spirit of Iodine Berliner was always there. But I think it latched into my memory because of the urban legend than necessarily the solidarity they expressed. The urban legends had that his pronunciation from Northeast Boston ended up rendering it in German as "I am a jelly donut," more than "I am one of you." Tends to lodge in the mind. That, by the way, I found out isn't true, but there it is. Or another way, think of the famous plays. We were well acquainted with Romeo and Juliet and the star-crossed lovers and their ill fate. And we have those quotes in our mind, whether or not we even enjoy Shakespeare all that much. Romeo, oh Romeo, where art thou, oh Romeo? Or good night, a thousand times good night. And on it goes. And we might even remember the very last line of the whole thing. For never was a story of more woe than this of Juliet and her Romeo. It's the sentimental wrapping up of the ultimate love story, the ultimate passion story, even though it gets awfully messy in the middle. But then we bring something else to it and expand our memory of it, and it has a different meaning. That line, that closing line, is actually spoken by the prince of the town, chastising the warring families in front of him for what their being enemies has brought them to. And it's fitting to the end of the prayer. Play. Hear it with some context. A gloomy peace this morning with it brings. The sun, for sorrow, will not show its head. Go hence to have more talk of these sad things. Some shall be pardoned and some shall be punished. For never was a story of more woe than this of Juliet and her Romeo. I dare say that quote puts a different spin on it, a different feel to it and around it. I think we're given the same thing in these sayings of the Sermon on the Mount. If you're listening, we started out with one of the most common and well-known sayings there is. Do unto others as you would have them do unto you. This articulation of the golden rule and the golden reality. And there's often these little clips and nuggets all the way forward. Fall from it. The wide gate and the narrow gate. The solid rock and the stand. A wolf in sheep's clothing. The sayings and the sentiment are so common that they find their way into our cultural speech without necessarily knowing where they come from. I'm willing to guess that if you'd ask somebody just randomly off the street, there's a reasonable possibility that you might have the source of the golden rule being somebody like Ben Franklin or something like that, than necessarily the words of Christ. They are words that are just out of time and out of place, but also out of context, out of the frame where they exist. This longer sermon and articulation of, okay, what does it mean to be part of what God is doing? I've long harbored an ambition when it comes to the Sermon on the Mount, and I think it would be an interesting experiment. One of these days, I want to go ahead and make this happen, and simply deliver the Sermon on the Mount as it is, as a sermon, from beginning to end. I'd like to work on presenting the whole sermon in this way, and to bring it to life as what it originally was, as spoken word in a context, in a time. I hesitate to do that for a couple of reasons. One, these words are important, and it needs to be done well, or not at all. But also just the reality of, I'm not entirely convinced that I get to fill in the red letter words of Christ, mortal that I am. It would be daunting to say, listen to my voice as that of Christ. But even so, I think there would be something really powerful in hearing those words in full, as a full thing standing alone as it is, and wrapping it in that different way of telling the story and hearing it for what they are. By themselves, our sayings are the words that we live by and offered as good advice for life. But as a whole, it's experience and context that we're given that reckons with why these words work the way that they do and how they are. And they have the authority of one who spoke them with power and promise, something solid that we can be led to and challenged by time and again. But that doesn't mean that these words come to us easily or their consequences are easily lived. The illustration of the wide and the narrow gate speaks to just that. In most of our speech and most of the time, we hear the wide and the narrow gate, we think automatically of that singular choice of, do you follow Christ or do you follow the world? I'll always remember when I was working in the yard on a work day at the church in Tucson, and there happened to come by some missionaries circulating through the neighborhood. And I got to talking to them and speaking to them, and they made it clear that because I was not immersed in my baptism, then I wasn't baptized. You got it wrong. And wouldn't you like to fix that? And I think this verse even came up of, well, you didn't get exactly that narrow gate. I kind of let them know that I'm not sure that the gate is really that narrow. or that particular in that case, but I appreciate their concern. But nevertheless, I think we sit well with this concept of the wide and the narrow, the easy and the challenging, the big and the small. To take seriously the words that we are given, and the honesty that Jesus himself is even having of saying, yeah, it's hard. It's challenging. And that we need to discern well how we are led into what is next. Given as we are to take the quotes by themselves and leave the broader context away, we get something different than what we would have in holding it together with something else. I am always struck with reading before and behind and how that changes how I read the text. We maybe go here because the little nuggets are easier to work with. A simple way of being on the right side than time and again being called to the work of discerning where the call lies to be part of the kingdom and where it does not. To be clear, I think this whole thing of the wide and the narrow gate, it's not necessarily that binary choice, as important as that is, but rather those often ongoing gray area choices of how do you let this out? Where do we find the time to love? Where do we find the time to adhere? Where do we find the time to follow and keep ourselves on one path or another? And that makes a difference. And that makes the different context. We began this whole series by saying that the Sermon on the Mount is our text. As Christians in the Anabaptist style, we embrace this sermon as our own. And it shapes us and it is us. And I don't think that I can be underestimated. Martin Luther, the great reformer, offered the ethics of the Sermon on the Mount as possibly only the working of God to say how utterly impossible any of this actually is. You have the Sermon on the Mount to basically tell you that, you know what? It's so far out of reach, it can't be done. So therefore, grace by itself is the only way forward. He takes great pains to set up two worlds in which we live and learn, a secular and a spiritual, and argues that it's the spiritual realm that is inhabited by the ethics of the kingdom, and the secular realm and responsibilities is where the more practical stuff gets done and is lived out. In his commentary on the sermon, he even addresses the feelings of we who would take this a little bit more closely together than separated apart, and complains that, quote, Anabaptists do not recognize the difference between the secular and the divine, much less there should be a distinctive doctrine and action in each realm. And this insistence, he argues, replaces the notion of grace with an emphasis on what we do. Elsewhere, he suggests that it's simply there and simply not workable on this side of heaven to do these heavenly things. And of course, he goes on to say, of course, in the secular world, you live as closely as you can to this, but somebody has to make the trains run on time. And that means you can't do all the rest of this. And you Anabaptists are simply irresponsible because you insist on making the divine relevant now and get confused along the way. But I would answer Brother Martin in this way. If there are two realms, as you suggest, that the one as the one way of being, that I wouldn't say that the realms have so much about being separate and different from one to the next, but rather it's a matter of saying, where do you live first, and how does that influence where you live in the secular? We live in a divine world, and we express that divine identity in the secular world as best we can. I'd ask, is not Jesus the Lord of both worlds, the divine and the secular, speaking to people in a very immediate and practical way in the sermon and elsewhere? And should we not take that seriously? And ultimately, even if they are two worlds with two different ways of being, I'd rather work the best I can at implementing the kingdom in the world now as we know it, knowing its imperfections and its fragility, than to pretend that the kingdom can ever only be waited on in hope and in promise. Because we need so much the world coming now, the best that we know it. But here's where I agree with Martin. This is our firm foundation. Our hearing of the word and doing it and living it and being everything that we can within it. But we do this in the context of grace, of Christ coming to us and revealing it to us in the first place. The way that we hear the whole of the sermon, the whole of the Christ, call of Christ, has everything to do with the encounter that we have in knowing grace of God through Christ. This is not a replacement for grace, but a response to grace and for grace. And it's entirely true that we will fail these foundational words. We will judge others. We will fall short of sharing the blessings that we've been given. We will worry about tomorrow, and on and on and on it goes. But we cannot lose heart for wanting something easier to do. We cannot lose heart for failing that way, because this is the way of Christ. To keep trying, to keep living, to keep incarnating God now, even in the most challenging circumstances. We need to hear these words not just as good ideas to be lived one day, but as challenges that call us always to something new. Our friends, as we hear these words, may we take them always close to heart and live them the best that we can through the costly discipleship born of present grace that makes Christ with us real, each and every day. Amen. By way of response, I invite you to sing together number 332, In Christ Alone. Please stand.